It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a growing number of state legislatures in the country are signing on to a plan for a national constitutional convention. Wisconsin could be next. We'll find out why coming up. First, the state's Joint Finance Committee is meeting at the state capitol today to look at several bills and some funding requests from different state agencies. Bills related to the opioid epidemic have been getting some special attention. In January, Governor Walker called a special session on opioid addiction. Today, lawmakers will take a closer look at bills that would aim to treat and prevent it. WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us now. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, there's been a lot of talk and focus on opioid addiction lately, and today is no exception. What are some of the key pieces of legislation that the lawmakers on Joint Finance are looking at?
And they've got a bunch here today, and these are all part of the governor's special session this year. One of the big ones is in terms of just how much it would cost the state is there'd be about $2.4 million per year set aside for treatment, alternative, and diversion programs. This is something that lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee heard a lot about during public hearings on the budget a few years ago. It kind of got their attention. You had a lot of church groups coming out and talking about how these programs can work for people as an alternative to incarceration. And so what they're doing this year in this budget, if this passes, is you'd have $2 million to continue what they've already done, another $150,000 to expand those programs to more counties. And then they'd set aside some money for the Joint Finance Committee to fund a new pilot program through the Department of Justice. Another one that kind of not as expensive but is interesting, definitely, it directs the UW to contract with someone to establish a recovery charter high school for a maximum of 15 students as a four-year pilot project. And so this would essentially be, you know, students who are trying to recover from addiction could be a part of this, you know, admittedly small school, and it would cover their mental health and behavioral health treatment. And that'd be about a $50,000 state grant, which is why this is before the budget committee today.
We've also heard lately on the show that there are parts of Wisconsin that are really underserved when it comes to addiction treatment, whether it's opioids, as we're talking about now, or meth. Is there anything in the new legislation that would try to extend more treatment to those areas?
Yeah, one of those would require the State Department of Health Services to create two or three additional opioid treatment programs in underserved and high need areas. These wouldn't have to necessarily be rural areas, but they could be. So this would be another $1 million per year where the state would try to, you know, go to places that don't have access to that treatment right now and provide it.
And this, to get a bit wonky here, this is stuff that came out of a special session earlier this year. We're not quite into the new state budget with this material, right?
No, not exactly. I mean, the special session is, it's sort of just, it has a name on it. It doesn't mean that they exactly have to change what they're doing in the legislature or anything like that. This is basically, the special session is an indication by the governor that we want to move forward in all this stuff. And when it comes to the bills that are going before the Finance Committee today, he's, you know, got a lot of support for these, including John Nygren, who's the assembly co-chair of the Finance Committee, has been an outspoken advocate on this issue particularly.
Talking to WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the Joint Finance Committee meeting today, looking at different pieces of legislation. We've been talking about opioid addiction-related laws so far. Sean, let's move on to some other things. There's a teen work bill, right, that would allow loosen up restrictions on how teens could find work.
Yeah, and this is something that's backed by the Grocers Association and the Restaurant Association, among some other business groups. It would let certain businesses employ 16 and 17-year-olds without obtaining a child labor permit. So essentially loosening it up for them. This is something that the, you know, AFL-CIO, the labor organization of the state, is against, but a wide variety of business groups do support it. You know, not something that's gotten a whole lot of attention yet this session, but that's before the committee today.
And then rural broadband is there. And this, again, is an issue we keep hearing about on this show. What is Joint Finance looking at as far as legislation?
Yeah, I think rural broadband, like opioid abuse, is something that lawmakers feel like it seems like they can't talk about enough, especially if they're from a rural area. This is something that, you know, it seems like, at least given the attention that is given at the Capitol here from rural lawmakers, this is an issue that really hits home in their districts. This would increase available funding for rural broadband grants by $11 million. Some of this has overlapped with what the governor's proposing in his budget. The issue obviously has his attention too. And so it would do that through a variety of ways, kind of funneling some money that's set aside for other technology purposes in the budget towards specific rural broadband grants. And, you know, again, the governor has talked about this. This is one of the issues that he highlighted when he was talking about how his budget is aimed at rural voters. And I think those rural voters have gotten more attention in this session, probably after last year's election, when you saw rural voters kind of put Donald Trump over the top in Wisconsin in a very close election for Wisconsin's electoral votes.
Let's talk about the role of the Joint Finance Committee for a moment. Usually has the adjective powerful before it when it shows
fair.
Up in the news. Obviously, or as I understand it, all of these pieces of legislation will still have to be passed by the Assembly and the Senate. What's up with the Joint Finance Committee? Why do they get to weigh in on it at this point?
They get to weigh in on it at this point because either these are bills that have a cost to the state, basically. And so you don't see all of the special session bills here in front of the Finance Committee, you know, all the heroin opioid special session bills. In fact, one of the more interesting ones that says that heroin users who overdose would be granted legal immunity is not before the committee. It doesn't have a fiscal note on it. You know, it doesn't have a cost to the state. And so that's one that's actually still sitting in committee. Everything else seems to be moving forward. Headed toward a vote in the legislature, but if it has a cost, it ought to, in theory, go before these guys.
And speaking of cost, Governor Walker's budget is out there on the table. Are we starting to see the Joint Finance Committee look at that?
Yeah, that's really going to kick off this week. You're going to have 3 days of meetings where Walker cabinet secretaries all go before the committee. And essentially, they get grilled. You know, legislators can ask him whatever they want. Those cabinet secretaries can make the case for the governor's budget. And so you're going to see that Tuesday through Thursday of this week. That's really the kickoff of the budget process. And then next week, it spills over into a series of six public hearings around the state. The first one in Platteville. And, you know, before you know it, they're going to be voting on pieces of the budget.
And you said they grill these different cabinet secretaries. Are there any who might be losing a little extra sleep in anticipation of this time around?
It's always interesting to watch how the Department of Administration secretary does at these things because, you know, that's essentially the right hand of the governor, the DOA is. And they'll be talking about, they have to answer for any piece of the governor's budget. And so that takes a while usually. Also, I think you're going to hear some pretty contentious testimony probably, or back and forth between the Department of Transportation secretary and the Joint Finance Committee this time around. The DOT with Governor Walker and the new secretary, Dave Ross, have taken a very hard line stand against any new taxes to pay for roads. You know, there are a lot of legislators on this committee who would rather go a different direction and feel like if you do a no new taxes budget, essentially you're creating or you're exacerbating long-term issues, when it comes to paying for roads in Wisconsin.
And with joint finance, it has a Republican majority reflecting the nature of both of the houses of the state government. Do they have the power to shut down or change pieces of the budget before they go to the Assembly and the Senate?
Yeah, they'll rewrite substantial pieces of the budget. And the way you've seen Republicans operate, whatever goes through finance is pretty close to the final product that passes the legislature. And so, they can take things out of the budget. The governor has a lot of power still with his veto pen. He can kind of tweak things when it gets to him, but he can't put stuff back in. And so that could be the role of the Finance Committee this time around as they look at the governor's budget. The governor wants to spend more in a variety of programs, leave without too much money in the bank at the end of the budget. There are some members of this committee that may not want to go that way. And so that's one thing that they can do.
They're the great colander of government.
Yeah, that's right. The sifting and winnowing through the colander of joint finance.
We'll end on the great metaphor. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He joined us to share the latest from the Capitol as the Joint Finance Committee takes up bills on opioid addiction and starts the budget resolution process. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says President Trump's proposal to strip federal funding from the arts and humanities would hurt not only the art world, but the American economy. He'll explain why coming up. Right now, state lawmakers have introduced a resolution in the state Senate that would add Wisconsin to a growing list of states seeking a constitutional convention. All of the states signing on want to add an amendment to the Constitution forcing the federal government to have a balanced budget. Supporters of the move say it's time to rein in the national debt, nearing $20 trillion, but critics say amending the Constitution to include that balanced budget amendment could have a negative impact for years to come, and the process could open the door to other unrelated amendments. Andrea Kaminsky joins us now. She's executive director of the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, and she's against this idea of a constitutional convention. Andrea, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what do you see as the potential main problem with a federal balanced budget constitutional amendment and this process, of course?
Yeah, well, the League, we really understand people's concerns about the federal debt, but really amending the U.S. Constitution is the wrong way to handle that problem. And in fact, it's a particularly dangerous path to take. And we have three reasons for this. One is that really it imperils all citizen rights that are currently protected in the U.S. Constitution, because a constitutional amendments convention can go in many different directions once it's happened. And it hasn't happened in more than 200 years since the first one. So we really don't know where it's going to go. And so it could put every citizen right at risk. That is voting rights, freedom of speech, definition of marriage, having three branches of government. I mean, really, this could be starting from back from zero. Who knows? Even prohibition, depending on who's there. But also, we believe that requiring a balanced budget for the federal government would put the government in a position where it could not respond to an economic recession or a national disaster or emergency without having to stop first and raise taxes. And so, you know, think of the recession in 2008. That could have become a full-blown depression under a balanced budget amendment. It would have been disastrous. And finally, the League believes our nation is changing, and that change is taking place in every state and every district. And in such a time, we really have to be prepared to respond quickly and flexibly to any crisis that comes up. And our Constitution is more than 200 years old, and it's had that flexibility. With individual amendments, we've been able to respond to changing times.
Yeah, let's talk about each of those in turn, actually. And for part one, a bit of a civics lesson that I've had to brush up on here. The way most of our amendments, all of our amendments, have happened is Congress says, okay, we're putting this out there, and then the states one at a time ratify it. And when you hear it,
that's
the right number of states, you got it. That's everything after the Bill of Rights. That's how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
This is a way we haven't tried, but the Constitution leaves it open, where the state legislatures initiate the process, and that's what some lawmakers are working on. So you're saying there would be, in effect, maybe an open door, not just for a balanced budget, but to, once it convenes, it could go just about anywhere.
That's right. And the convention itself would have the ability, just as both houses of Congress, both houses of our state legislature can set their rules, the convention would have that ability to set its own rules. And there is some attempt in our legislature mm-hmm. to limit what our delegates, if this happened, what the Wisconsin delegates could vote on, and to say, nope, they can only vote on the balanced budget. Well, there are 49 other states that are going to be there, and they really can't control that.
Well, but if I've seen that here in Wisconsin, the rule being if you start to propose another idea, you're out. We're yanking you as mm-hmm. a delegate. If enough states were to do that, do you think it's possible if states coordinate to have a narrowly focused, we're only going to talk about this balanced budget amendment?
Well, there are 28 states that have already passed these resolutions, some of them dating back to the 1970s. And the resolutions, you know, who knows what people had in mind and how all these resolutions are written. I really think you're leaving open a door for too much uncertainty.
And are there any constitutional safeguards to say once you convene this convention, you can only do X but not Y?
Well, we don't know 100%
because
we haven't tried it since we wrote the Constitution, since our forebears wrote the Constitution. Yeah.
Talking to Andrea Kaminsky from the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, talking about an effort by a number of states, possibly soon, including Wisconsin, to convene a constitutional convention, the main goal, the balanced budget amendment idea. But she's saying that could open the door to a lot of other amendments once that were to convene. How many states would have to be involved to make this thing a reality?
Well, 34 states. So it'd be 2/3 of the states would have to call for the article. It's called an Article 5 Convention of the States. There are 28 that already have done so. And there are another 5 where there are active proposals. So this is something we really need to be on top of.
And let's get to your second objection, the idea of the balanced budget amendment itself. So a constitutional requirement that the budget is balanced. And you worry that that would tie the hands of government in dealing with an emergency. And sometimes the balanced budget amendment is presented as you can't have an unbalanced budget except in a case of emergency. You could have that opening. So if with that clarification, with that additional rule there, would that be okay?
Well, that would be better, but it would not be. We still don't think that that is a way that a country as great as the United States should be preparing for an emergency. We don't think it offers what we need just to be even prepared for the changes that are already taking place in our communities and, you know, with changing demographics in the country.
I think people look at Congress and the federal system in general and say, well, maybe that's a bad idea, this amendment, but look at what we've got. We've got a system that doesn't seem to be addressing annual deficits and the growing national debt. So is there another solution?
Well, of course, we believe that people should be asking these questions before an election and studying up and then electing officials who, rather than who are ready to meet the basic needs of the population while also being fiscally responsible. We don't think that forcing a balanced budget is the answer.
Well, part of the idea behind the Constitution is to protect ourselves in some ways from excesses of thinking as a democracy. In this case, it's very tempting for lawmakers to lower taxes. That's very popular, and it's very tempting to increase spending. People love it when money is being spent on them. So there's this built-in incentive in some ways for a deficit. So wouldn't it be worth it to have a constitutional safeguard against that?
Really, what we need is a whole different way of looking at funding government and what government is for. Government is here to serve the needs of the electorate, of the people. And this idea that we have to cut revenue and then the idea that well, we don't want to increase services except services in my district. You know, and I don't think that putting an amendment into our fundamental document, our Constitution, to make politicians behave is the answer. That's a very drastic approach, and it's a dangerous one.
And then getting to your third point of concern, the first was this could open the door to other amendments. The second is worry about the balanced budget amendment itself. And the third was polarization today. And people will use the phrase, you know, most polarized since, you name it, Reconstruction, Civil War, whatever they want to put it. Why is that an extra concern for you if we were to convene a constitutional convention now?
Well, it's really more that we feel that the nation is undergoing change. Mm-hmm. And that we need to have the flexibility that is the level of flexibility that our country, you know, that our current Constitution has afforded us. Now, going into a constitutional convention with our current level of polarization sounds really scary, because people are at the far ends of the spectrum, and it's like one side or the other is going to win out. It should be that's not governing, and that's not the way our original Constitution was adopted, and that's part of why it has served us so well for so long.
Well, the original Constitution had a lot of closed-door horse trading going on in it, too. I mean, maybe that would be, you could see it as a refresher for democracy if you got people in that, probably won't be a smoke-filled room anymore, but that, you know, hey, you guys come up with something.
Well, it scares me under today's winner-take-all politics, how that might play out. And we do think that our current document was written with great care. It came through a process of compromise, and it really has served us well.
What would it take to have it, both at the leadership level in Washington and among citizens in general, I guess, a civic renewal, a renewal of interest in working to fix government and compromise to fix government?
Well, that's what we all want to know. And I think it's just very important for us all to understand what government is for, and that it is a matter of, this is how the people take care of the common good, about how we all get along better in this society. And, one can always hope that in the next election there'll be a better understanding of that. Certainly the League takes that approach in our discussions about the state budget, which we're working on now. It's not a matter of us and them. It's a matter of us and how we're all going to coexist in this space together.
We'll leave it there for now. Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That's Andrea Kaminsky, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. She joined us today to talk about calls for a constitutional convention to add a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, why she's worried it could be a bad idea. Coming up after the news, our guest makes the case for arts and humanities in the age of the algorithm. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the news that the State Department issued a permit for the construction of the contentious Keystone XL pipeline. First, earlier this month, President Trump released his federal budget proposal, which includes the elimination of 19 government agencies. Those include the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our next guest says cuts like this to federal funding for the arts and humanities would be a huge blow not just to the arts community, but to the American economy and our ability to compete in the global marketplace. Christian Maspier joins us now. He's the author of the book Sensemaking, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He's co-founder and senior partner at Red Associates, a strategy consulting company based in the human sciences. Christian, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's talk about the age of the algorithm. We hear all the time how big data is going to help companies improve our lives at a personal level, at the economic level. Are we in the age of the algorithm?
I think we're in the age of talking a lot about it. It seems like there's more talk about it than there really are big data things. I mean, I've been working in the business world and in the advanced sort of analytics space for a long time, and I'm yet to see really great solutions based on it. But sure, it's a time where we have access to data that we didn't have access to before, and we're just still struggling organizing it and making sense of it.
And at the same time, we hear that the humanities maybe aren't as important, arts aren't, colleges should focus more on business and data analysis, things like that. We need fewer programs in the humanities. Are we, as a culture, turning against things like the arts and the humanities at the same time?
Unfortunately, I think so, and that's why I wrote a book about it. I was not, I mean, I'm, as you can hear in my quaint accent, I'm not from America. I'm from Denmark, and when I arrived here a decade ago, I was rather surprised by sort of the general tone in the debate that if you, I mean, I heard a lot that if you were studying, say, history or English or something like that, you were looking at a future of making hamburgers or something like that in a job that wasn't what you sort of originally hoped it would be. And I don't think that's the case. I know it isn't the case. And I think that right now we're in the middle of another sort of round of cutting down on essential components of any society. But also what I want to say in my latest book is that there are very practical skills coming out of the humanities. Not just, it's a delightful thing to listen to music and hear stories and look at art, but it's also a skill of engaging with other people and other cultures, and that's a skill that is necessary for competitiveness and for businesses and so on.
Yeah, talk more about how understanding the humanities, appreciating them. You say this, we're not talking about soft skills. These are hard skills that we need in the business world if we're going to innovate and compete. How connect the dots for us.
Right. So let's say you are in an automaker in Michigan, and you are living among people that are like you, and you want to make vehicles for, say, the Brazilian market or for the Western Chinese market or for Indonesia. And they live different lives there. They live different. It's maybe the first time a family has gotten together and bought a vehicle, and it's a big deal for them, which is different from buying your 57th, you know, family vehicle in your family if you come from a place like Michigan. So understanding what that situation is like is absolutely crucial to organize the components of the car, how it's designed, how you think about features and so on. So this engagement with other people and understanding what's going on in their life is absolutely crucial if you make software or cars or telecom services or radio. Whatever you, whenever you want to sell something to people or want to design something to people that are not like you, you need to engage in their world and their life. And the humanities is not the only place, but it certainly is a place, and I would say the best place, to train yourself in understanding what somebody else's life is like. So if you study paintings from the 1920s in France, you will have to put yourself into the position of somebody living like they did then and seeing what they thought was beautiful and what was right and what was wrong and so on. So, and the same goes with if you listen to music from China that's 400 years old, you will have to experience the world as they saw it then. So it's sort of a training ground. The humanities is a training ground to thinking like someone that figures out what other people need and what will be helpful and how to talk to them and so on. So it's a fundamental condition of business, and right now we're undermining it.
Talking to Christian Massberg, talking about his new book, Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He says we need more, not less, focus on the humanities and the arts, not because they're nice and fun, but because they're crucial to our economic success, to our creativity, our ability to innovate. Christian, can you point toward companies that maybe have gone wrong by not appreciating these skills that we can get from the humanities?
Right. I think, I mean, unfortunately, if you take a walk down the aisle of any supermarket or if you look at a lot of the products that are being produced, they are not made with much sophistication in terms of understanding people. But there are some companies that are really good at it, but we can get back to that. But if you take, I mean, a couple of days ago, there was a big scandal that YouTube, which is a Google company, was promoting people's advertising. So basically people that pay YouTube to put advertising on the channels, but doing it around very disturbing websites. So they had no ability to see, so the algorithm that they were using to place ads had no ability to see what was seen in our culture as a reasonable website to place things on and what wasn't. It was just following people. so without the contextual understanding of what is reasonable and what is good taste in our society, you can end up placing your customers' ads, like YouTube did, on completely wrong things. Another topic, another area that if we go back to the automaker, one of the big things that people are that the big automakers are promoting right now are technologies of driverless vehicles or driverless technologies, like making sure that the car stays in lane, which is a technology called lane assist. Now, if you go to India or Brazil or China, there are no lanes, and if there are lanes, then they're not accepted in the way you drive, which means that it's an absolutely ridiculous position to take in those markets to say that the car has lane assist, because that doesn't exist in the way that they drive or the way that the roads are made. So there you have a sort of a cultural misunderstanding between a place that has roads and with lanes in them, and where those lanes are accepted as a reasonable thing, yet you have other cultures that aren't like that. So that's another example of just a misunderstanding of what you promote and what you put into a vehicle.
And your solution is the title of your book, Sense Making. What do you mean when you say sense making? How can we develop this skill?
Right. Sense making is just a word I chose for the ability to synthesize several kinds of data in order to understand why we're doing what we're doing. So it would be, in the case of vehicles, it would be sales numbers and algorithms and all those kinds of things in terms of understanding how much and where and so on, but also why people are doing what they're doing. And that's a different sort of skill that maybe comes out of the human sciences, that is about observing and interpreting the world. So the good sense makers that I'm describing in the book, and I'm describing 10 different ones, it's an investor, it's a teacher, it's a conflict negotiator, it's a winemaker, so different sort of people in society that all use this skill to understand the people that they're dealing with. And what is common among them is that they all have a data-driven way of looking at the world, but also a sensitivity to other people, which is something that you can cultivate by engaging with other people, but also engaging with the different kinds of products that our culture have, which would be our songs and our music and our poetry and so on, which is a way to understand each other.
We're talking to Christian Maspier now about his new book, Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in your own life, the value of training in some element of the humanities, the arts? Has it helped you outside, beyond maybe the classroom, beyond the cover of the book? What do you think about proposals to cut federal funding for the arts and the humanities? Do you think that could have positive or negative effects? What role has art played in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a few moments. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Christian Maspier is with us. His new book is Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were the arts, were the humanities part of your education? A big enough part, do you think? How did it help you, if at all? Or did you go for everything but the arts and the humanities? How did that work out for you? What do you think of the role of arts, humanities, and the kind of thinking, the kind of empathy our guest says they can provide? Does that help you in your professional life? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Lomira. Brian, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today? I got two quick ones real fast. I had a friend of mine who was absolutely brilliant. In the early days of computing, he set up a computer program to float skyscrapers on soft soil. He got to a level of company where they're promoting him, sent him back to college to take humanities courses and leave his engineering basically at the office. And that was the only way he was going to get promoted. The second little story is that Chevrolet spent a lot of time and money setting up Latin America car distributor program with a model that they had, and they brought all the cars down to Spanish-speaking countries, and the problem was that they weren't selling. It occurred to no one at all in the marketing area that the car Nova, the Chevy Nova, translated meant actually no go. So there's a real necessity for an understanding of cross-cultural communication, languages in our country, and the capacity for understanding other cultures.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. A couple points there, Christian. And you talk about that advancing in the job. You point out that, yeah, right out of college, say, that computer science degree or engineering degree can pay more. But the people who hit the highest levels a lot of the times and the people who really innovate, a lot of them have humanities backgrounds.
It's rather surprising, isn't it, that when you look at the discourse in the public world right now, I mean, if you listen to what people said on the campaign trail 6 months ago and what they're still saying now, is that if you have a humanities degree, you'll never make any money. Yet, if you look at census data and you look at the top 5% earners in America, three times as many people have a humanities background as computer science background. And there are all kinds of reasons for that, but it is surprising that at a certain level in the big companies of America, you got to be a rounded person. You got to have a very a cultured way of dealing with different cultures, different kinds of people, and so on. Which means that the people that really bubble up to the top are people with a history background or an arts history background, and so on. And also, if you look at the list that I have in the book of the executives, the CEOs, and the sort of the top people of our society with a background in French or history or English or something like that, it's remarkable how many of them are actually, from a world that you wouldn't think they are from. But I think it's the combination of a humanities background with a practical look at the world, or sort of a business savvy look at the world, that seems to be the combination that ends up making the most money in America. And that's not why I'm saying it. It's just a curious fact that it's not the computer scientists that make all the money. It's the humanities people.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brian. We'll go next to Rod on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I have a degree in history from the University of Wisconsin. I'm retired. I had a very successful career, spent 23 years in Europe, and my history degree was invaluable. I was trained in history not to know when, but why. And I studied the culture, the music, the art and everything about a country, not just who was the king or queen. And I found I was able to deal very successfully with engineers, with scientists. One comment, Albert Speer, Minister of Munitions under the Third Reich, said one of the reasons Nazi Germany was so horrible was because everybody was trained, as he was an architect, to be totally technical, and they couldn't see the soul of what was coming.
Rod, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there, Christian. What do you think?
Well, I agree that if you want to engage, if you're American and you want to have a successful career in Europe, it is helpful to understand who are the people living there and what's their background and why do they think the way they think. And I think that's what he's talking about here. I think, though, it's important to understand it. It's the combination of things. My problem is that the pendulum is swinging so far towards science and technology that the only thing you ought to study if you're, I don't know, 17 years old right now is science and technology. That's the only thing that will give you a job in the future. And what I'm saying is that's too far. I don't want the other way around where we're all going to be historians and study English. We need to study a diverse set of things, and we need to be able to work together. And I think that's what he's talking about here, that he could bring the science and technology people a perspective and an understanding of why people are doing what they're doing, and that can lead to great innovations and great sort of technology as well.
Thanks for that call. Christian Maspier is with us, author of Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. Back to our callers now, Mark with us in Rockford, Illinois. Mark, hi.
Hi. And I think this is an excellent conversation. One of the things that Christian had just mentioned, I think, is so true, is that when you have multiple different types of disciplines that you draw your knowledge from. For example, both of my parents were artists. My dad was a commercial graphic illustrator. My mom taught art in grade school. Got a brother who never had any formal other than undergraduate, you know, I mean, high school and grade school art, who makes his living and extremely well as a graphic illustrator. He's worked for most of the major comic book networks and companies, and he's actually a co-creator on a couple of the Cartoon Network cartoons. And what that has given me is it's given an attorney who uses analytical skills a lot. It's given me the ability to draw on different ways of looking at things, which allows me to approach problems from ways that, you know, escape many other people who have been, you know, siloed into one mindset.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. So Christian, an attorney there who says his artistic background lets him approach problems from different perspectives, if I could borrow a term from art.
I would wish we had more attorneys like that. but I think in general, I think he's right on that it's the combination of perspectives and not just one perspective. And if we think that machines, in the case of algorithms and sort of computer science, is going to think for us, we're probably mistaken. And I think what we're doing right now is that we are undermining our future ability to train people, to train our kids and train, you know, people that want to study in university and study in college, to give them other perspectives than just one. And since they're now they're closing down the National Endowments of the Arts and the National Endowment of the Humanities, which are already very small compared to what we invest in technology and science, it's sort of the final blow to a system that delivers these multiple perspectives on things. And that's scary for our companies, and it's scary for our public sector, and it's scary for our kids that they can't get to study the things that that they want to study. Some of them want to study. So I would say that to your, you know, if your child, if your daughter wants to study English, or if your son wants to study English and your daughter wants to study medicine, that's all fine. They're all good ways to go into the future. It's not just the engineers and the doctors that would be successful.
Mark, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Dee with us in Green Bay. Dee, hi.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. I wanted to share with you the fact that I'm a retired professor of the humanities. I'm also a writer, so I continue with my work. And when I was a professor teaching my students literature, creative writing, and so on, I found that what they ended up becoming, and increasingly so as they became older, as very sharp and articulate ladies and gentlemen. They were highly persuasive. People, I think, gravitate towards that kind of communicator. And so I feel in any field, if you have someone who can communicate as a poet can, with very concrete and descriptive and persuasive language, success is just around the corner. I also feel that, you know, when we talk about the art of the deal, you have to speak in such a way that you are convincing. You have to understand rhetoric, and you have to understand how, if you want people to be encouraged by your work, it has to be beautiful.
Dee, thanks a lot for the call. We're just about out of time. Christian, briefly, as we wrap up, you said the pendulum has gone in the big data, algorithm, science and technology direction. Are you starting to see it come back toward the middle, where we're using a little of both sides of this?
No, I think it's going in the wrong direction, and that's why I wrote a book about it. I say that, I mean, it sounds like on the debate coming out of Silicon Valley or something like that the only thing that'll be safe for the future is if our children learn how to code. And I would say, based on the last caller, that I think also reading and writing will be helpful. And that's basically just what I'm saying, is that we can't go away from those skills, and we are right now.
We'll leave it there for now. Christian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Christian Maspier, author of the book Sensemaking, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He's co-founder and senior partner of Red Associates, a strategy consulting company based in the human sciences. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the topic. Do you see this value of humanities? Do you think we're turning too far away from it on the side of algorithms and big data? You can share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Central Time Facebook page. On Friday, I mentioned this weekend's Wisconsin Spelling Bee Championship. Now we have our winners, the top three headed to the national competition. Top three spellers, Maria Bautista of Madison, Hannah Gauss from Kenosha, Kieran McKinney from West Salem. The winning word, rhizograph, that's with a Z, a device that measures the growth of plant roots. The penultimate word was apteryx, a flightless bird. I shared my spelling bee fail words from elementary school. They were easier words than those, by the way. You shared some of yours, too. Here they are. On Facebook, Hannah writes, I was in about fourth grade at a spelling bee. I was one of the last three. I was given the word woman to spell. She says she'd seen on TV where you can ask for it to be used in the sentence. She says, I was too afraid to look like a total geek, therefore gave the spelling to women with an E, not an A, costing me the game. Never gotten the two confused since. Amy writes on Facebook, my daughter got tripped up with the word Baroque in third grade. Everyone else had words like rabbit. She had the last laugh, valedictorian of her high school. Sarah tweets, maintenance was what knocked me out of my elementary spelling bee. Never miss it now. And Marianne from Fish Creek emailed, in fourth grade, my son John misspelled the word dessert, two S's, the kind you eat. He spelled desert instead, one S. For the rest of the years he lived at home, he had to spell the word before he was served his dessert. Thanks so much for sharing your misspellings. You can keep doing that at the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.